The Clean Elections Commission is considering a new rule to force so-called dark money groups to disclose their donors. But the panel's plan is clashing with the Secretary of State's office again.
This, I think, seems like it's going to bring a pretty significant new chapter to that fight. We heard a lot of Cold War references in today's media.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, a new lawsuit aims to change Arizona's civil asset forfeiture laws. Navajo voters relax language requirements for some political candidates.
The impact the I-10 bridge collapse has had on truckers.
And retirement communities are trying to meet baby boomers' needs.
I've said for years somebody needs to build a retirement community for Grateful Dead fans. I could fill it overnight.
Plus the desert after dark, and we play the quiz.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody.
The Arizona Citizens Clean Elections Commission this morning decided to continue looking at a proposed rule which would require some so-called dark money groups to disclose where they get their cash. For more on this, I'm joined by Jeremy Duda of the Arizona Capital Times, who is at today's meeting. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Mark.
So what would this rule actually do?
What this rule would do is it would basically take the state statute that was passed in this past session that redefined political committee, that defined political committee on a two-prong test, that A, you have to raise or spend at least $500 trying to influence an election during an election cycle, and you have to have the primary purpose of trying to influence an election. If you meet these two standards, you're a political committee and subject to reporting your expenditures and, more importantly, in this case, your contributors. Now, what this rule that's being proposed to the commission would do is essentially, it would take this to a one-prong test. They would say, because primary purpose is not defined in state law, they're trying to figure out how to define this. And what it would say is, if you raise or spend at least $500 trying to influence an election, you are basically presumed to have the primary purpose of influencing elections. And at that point, this would trigger these reporting requirements, and now an entity that met those requirements would have the opportunity to rebut that presumption with through clear and convincing evidence, which would essentially put the onus on them, on a lot of these nonprofits or corporations or whatever groups are spending money in elections.
It looked like there were a lot of people at today's meeting to hear about this. What were they saying about this proposed change?
Well, most of the people there didn't speak. The ones who did speak is, we had, Eric Spencer, the state election director from the Secretary of State's office, which is staunchly opposed to this rule. They have repeatedly butted heads with the Clean Elections Commission over whether the commission even has the authority to do stuff like this against people who, candidates and committees who aren't clean elections candidates. They are strongly opposed to this. You had the head of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce, Glenn Hammer, also very staunchly opposed. You had some testimony from some folks from the Arizona Advocacy Network, a liberal progressive group that's very much in favor of what they're trying to do.
So what's next?
Well, they will open. They've been taking public comment on this for the past 2 months, and initially it was thought they may vote on this, but now that they are changing this somewhat, they're going to open this up for public comment for another 28 days, hoping to get some feedback, some input. Now, the Clean Elections Commission has asked Mr. Spencer from the Secretary of State's office that rather than just go attacking what you believe is our lack of authority, which is a major point of disagreement, said we hope you will participate in this process and provide some input to us on what your office believes primary purpose means. Now, what Mr. Spencer told me and several other reporters after the meeting is that they will, in no way, shape, or form, will they participate in that process. Instead, what the what the Secretary of State's office wants is the Clean Elections Commission to basically voluntarily cede some of the power they have claimed over campaign finance regulation. Now, none of these things are going to be resolved in the next 28 days. What's likely to happen next is, on their next meeting, which I believe is scheduled for August 20th, they're going to come back. The Commissioner Kester, the chairman of the commission, basically indicated that, hey, we're going to pass this at the next meeting, but we'd like some public input. And then the next step, of course, will be a lawsuit.
Right. It sounds like there's maybe a bigger battle brewing here between the Clean Elections Commission and the Secretary of State's office.
Yes, this is only the most recent chapter in, a battle that's been going on for a couple of years. It had become kind of heightened, I think, especially, this year since Michelle Reagan became Secretary of State, and there's been, a bit more conflict. And this, I think, seems like is going to bring a pretty significant new chapter to that fight. We heard a lot of Cold War references in today's meeting, mostly from Mr. Spencer, tear down this wall and stuff like that. And it was getting pretty ugly, and I don't really see this getting any better before it gets worse.
Jeremy Duda with the Arizona Capital Times. Jeremy, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
A new lawsuit challenges Arizona's civil asset forfeiture laws. Filed by the ACLU and the law firm Perkins Coie, it centers on Rhonda Cox, a Pinal County woman whose truck was seized. She was also told if she fought that and lost, she'd have to pay prosecutors' legal fees. Jay Cabo is a partner in the litigation group at Perkins Coie. And Jay, is the suit arguing the laws are being misapplied and that the money seized isn't going where it's supposed to go?
I would say that that is part of the heart of the argument that we are making, but that's certainly not the exclusive center of the case. The spending that we have been able to observe through public records from both Pinal County and from around the state suggests that there are some real questions about where the money is being spent, but that's not Rhonda's challenge. Rhonda's challenge is both facially and as applied to her to the constitutionality of the laws in the first place. And it is really, I guess, two things. First of all, that the people doing the seizing and the prosecuting have a direct financial incentive in the outcome of their cases. And that's a due process problem. So whether it's Rhonda's case or any case, the way that the civil asset forfeiture laws are set up in Arizona takes the decision making about how to spend that money away from where it should be, which is the legislature, and leaves it in the hands of the people who take the money in the first place.
So is this a problem with how the law is written or how the law is being interpreted?
Oh, it's definitely a problem with how the law is written and how the law is applied. The conduct in which the defendants in the case have engaged in seizing the money and then keeping it for their own purposes, that is okay under Arizona law. The problem is that Arizona law is not okay under the federal and the state constitution.
Are there other states that do it better that Arizona, if it were inclined, if the legislature were inclined to rewrite these laws, that they could look to and say, okay, here's another way that could be done?
Yes, there are many other states, and the federal system does it much better. The easiest fix would be for the legislature to simply pass a law that mandated that any funds seized through civil forfeiture go to the state treasury.
What about the argument that law enforcement folks sometimes make, which basically goes along the lines of, well, we're the ones out there enforcing these laws. We're the ones who are coming across this money and collecting it. Why shouldn't we keep it for the things that we need that the state isn't paying for?
Well, the state should be able to make that choice for itself. And the state should make that choice through the legislature and through the governor, through the regular process of appropriation. No one is denying that law enforcement needs money. But when you have a direct financial benefit for law enforcement in the way in which they work, you have a huge moral hazard, and you see it playing out in this case where you can look at the spending records. And for example, attached to the lawsuit is an audit report done by the Pinal County Office of Internal Audit, which heavily criticized the spending in that office. And the reason why that can go on is there's no check or balance on it. The money is spent by the same people who seize it.
Are you hopeful that the end result of your lawsuit will be that the state has to rewrite its civil forfeiture law?
Yes. We are hopeful that the law will be declared unconstitutional, which it is, and that the state legislature will finally take up meaningful reform of forfeiture. Several states have done so recently, New Mexico recently. There's a ballot proposition in California right now to amend or abolish civil asset forfeiture. No one is challenging the use of criminal forfeiture in this case, right? So if, as part of a criminal case, a prosecutor were to charge a defendant with a forfeiture count as part of the indictment, they could still take that money. But in criminal forfeiture, which is very lightly used in this state, defendants have a much broader ability to invoke their what we think of as traditional criminal procedure rights. For example, in a criminal case, defendants have a right to counsel. And if they can't afford counsel, we all know that one will be appointed for them. In a forfeiture case, there's no such right. So while if you're lucky enough to be able to pay a lawyer, the vast majority of forfeiture cases are low, relatively low dollar seizures where hiring a lawyer is almost cost prohibitive.
Jay Kabu is a partner in the litigation group at the law firm Perkins Coie, which is one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit. We also reached out to the Pinal County Sheriff's and Attorney's Office. In a written statement, the Sheriff's Office says it's, quote, not in a position to comment on any civil actions that are pending or have yet to be adjudicated. The Pinal County Attorney's Office also said it couldn't comment. Perkins Coie is an underwriter of KJZZ.
Earlier this week, a majority of Navajo Nation voters decided to eliminate the requirement that presidential and vice presidential candidates be fluent in Navajo. That ends a battle that hit its height during last fall's presidential campaign. KJZZ's Laurel Morales has been reporting on the issue and joins us now. So, Laurel, what will change now going forward?
So from here on out, when voters go to the polls to cast their ballot for president and vice president, they will determine the candidate's language skills and essentially weigh whether it's important to speak Dine Bazad fluently. So the next presidential election is 2018, so they'll have the opportunity to put this law into action then. And it makes it possible for voters to elect a non-Navajo speaker.
So, Laurel, what led up to this specific event? We had heard, certainly in the most recent presidential election, which I'd like you to give us more background on, of course, was this a new development, though? Was this something that happened in the last year or so? Or had this been an issue that Navajos had been thinking about or struggling with for a while?
It really came to a head last year. Chris Desjani, early on in his campaign in the primary, admitted he was still working on his language skills. So after he won the primary, a couple of his opponents took him to court because up until Tuesday, when you signed up to run for president or vice president, you were required to speak and understand Navajo fluently. The Supreme Court eventually disqualified him for refusing to take a Navajo proficiency test. The tribal council tried to pass a law that would have left it up to the voters. But that sort of made people question which branch of government was in charge because the Supreme Court had already disqualified him. So some election officials were also forced to step down because they didn't follow the Supreme Court order.
So what have you heard now from tribal members about the new policy now that the vote has gone through?
Many of Deschini's supporters have said it wasn't his fault that he didn't speak Navajo fluently. And he was working on his language skills, but he's one of thousands of Native Americans whose parents were forced to go to federally run boarding schools where they essentially tried to erase language and culture. Many were also relocated. And so it's kind of amazing at this point that more people speak Navajo than any other American Indian language. But much of the younger generation does not. And some say the old mandate discouraged younger people from coming back to the reservation to help the tribe. Opponents to the referendum say the passing of this referendum diminishes the importance of the language. And with that, it diminishes cultural identity and the tribe's sovereignty. The current president, Russell Begay, sided with opponents saying that, people were being brainwashed to think that language wasn't that important.
So finally, ultimately, based on what you just said, this could turn out to be a pretty significant change. Is that how it's being viewed? Is this sort of a moment in time that people will remember?
It seems pretty historic from where I stand. It opens the door to younger candidates who may bring other skills to the table. But what does it say about the importance of the tribe's stories and traditions and identity? Much of the Navajo government business was done in Navajo. There will be something lost in translation, from what I hear from people who are traditional and speak Dine Bazad fluently. If the next candidate doesn't speak Navajo very well, how will he communicate or she communicate with the elders who speak only Navajo? So many of the 566 federally recognized tribes do not have language requirements for their leaders, But some would say, some might argue that many of those tribes are losing what makes them unique.
KJZZ's Laurel Morales reporting on the Navajo Nation vote this week that relaxes language requirements for the tribal presidential and vice presidential candidates. Some are concerned that a vote like this could eventually lead to the Navajo language going away. David Lightfoot is a professor of linguistics at Georgetown University.
There is good reason to believe that languages are becoming extinct as a common occurrence. The consequences are that languages embody a lot of sort of cultural knowledge, which then gets lost. Another thing that's lost is information about language diversity.
Mm.
So linguists are very interested in the commonalities of language, but also the differences. As we lose languages, we lose information about the kinds of diversity that are there.
How common is a generational shift as it relates to language? Certainly, young people tend to have their own language. If we look at how social media has changed things, how people use Twitter as they text, is that simply common and there are always generational differences, or are we seeing more of that?
Yes. It's ubiquitous. Even languages that are quite isolated, you know, for example, Icelandic, languages shift from generation to generation. We know this from looking back over, you know, say, 19th century novels. The language is, you know, clearly the same in some sense, but there are differences. Go back a little further to Shakespeare, the differences are more significant. Go back to Chaucer, you're close to dealing with a different language. And this is normal.
How closely tied is language to culture? How obvious is it that that is impactful in our lives all the time?
Oh, it's a major factor. The way in which we speak, the different accents that we have are cultural phenomena. When people develop their language system, they're also establishing a kind of cultural identity developing a language that they share with a particular group.
I don't want to say it's a zero-sum game, but is there any sort of balance point to perhaps losing a language, but at the same time we're gaining others? Do we tend to think too much about the language we're losing as opposed to, well, even if we don't think this language is quite as good, it's not as formal, it is still a language and we're still developing languages as we go?
That's a very good point. And yes, we are developing languages. We talk about, think about English. These days, it's appropriate really to think about Englishes, that there are different languages, which are significantly different. They all have a sort of a common history. And again, this is not unusual. So, another case where this happened was Latin. So Latin was a dominant language in Europe 2,000 years ago. And now it's spoken in Paris and Lisbon and Madrid. We don't call it Latin anymore. We call it Spanish and Portuguese and French. But it's sort of modern Latin. It's a result of the developments that have taken place over the last 2,000 years. So yes, Latin is gone, but French, Romanian, Italian, Sardinian are here.
David Lightfoot, linguistics professor at Georgetown.
Still to come, truckers have been adding time and cost to their trips since the bridge on I-10 in California collapsed.
You know, this is in the middle of the desert, and the reality is that no, there's not a good detour. I mean, these roads aren't made for that kind of capacity.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Nothing exciting on the Valley freeways yet this afternoon. There is one accident to tell you about. It's on I-10 westbound at 67th Avenue, and it's in the median. Valley weather for the rest of today, we should stay mostly sunny and peak at about 105. Then for tonight, mostly clear, but there is a 10% chance for rain. Overnight lows will be in the mid-80s. And then for tomorrow, partly cloudy, expect a high of 104. Currently, relative humidity is at 18%. We have some high, thin clouds, otherwise clear skies, and 100 degrees at KJZZ. It's the show at 223.
K.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, presenting the new 2016 Subaru Legacy, the 36 mpg midsize sedan redefined. Ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
Transportation officials say the bridge on I-10 in California that collapsed on Sunday will reopen tomorrow, although only one lane in each direction. The closure came after flooding and had cut off the main route between Phoenix and Los Angeles. It sparked conversations about the state of infrastructure in Arizona and the country. For more on this, we turn to John Harvey. He's a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of California, Davis, and director of the UC Pavement Research Center.
Unusual events like that are hard to design for. The standard should reflect the risk and the balance between risk abatement and cost. That's basically the gist of civil engineering. A mentor I had at one point said, an engineer is somebody who can do for 50 cents what any darn fool can do for a dollar. almost anybody can design a structure that will more than likely never fail under any circumstances. But the problem you have is the cost of that overdesign. You know, that's overdesign unless that highly unusual event occurs. So what you're balancing is the risk of this event occurring and what the how often that type of event might occur versus the cost of designing for a very rare event. One of the issues that we're facing right now, and the American Society of Civil Engineers is actually establishing a committee to evaluate this right now, is that a general assumption when you set up standards and specifications for design is that we can look at the past and assess what the risk is for events that will occur in the future. And that's called stationarity. And one of the issues that we're having, particularly with climate change or the potential for climate change, is how well can we predict the probability of these events in the future based on how often they've occurred in the past? And that's one of the biggest issues that the folks who are going to be looking at those bridges are going to be facing.
So basically, what do you do if the flood of the century happens every decade or so?
Exactly.
Is there research being done or studies being done into potential new materials to be used for roads, bridges, other types of projects like that?
Absolutely. Worldwide, and particularly in the United States, there are some pretty comprehensive research programs going on at the national level and in a number of states. So in particular, universities in Arizona are investigating extremely hot temperatures for pavement design. Universities in California ourselves and universities in Arizona are looking at the incorporation of tire rubber into asphalt because these are goals of our state government, which are not necessarily national goals and don't get much attention at the national level.
And when you talk about different kinds of materials, I would imagine that the cost of actually implementing them also factors into A, the amount of research they get, and B, whether or not they're actually adopted.
Absolutely. Back to the definition of an engineer. We could build the roads out of titanium. They'd probably last a long time. Can't afford it. So what's happened in pavement research and implementation, and the states use this when they're deciding what to do for a given project, is something called life cycle cost analysis. And life cycle cost analysis looks at not only the initial cost of building or fixing a road, but then over a longer analysis period, usually 20 to 50 to 60 years, what are the impacts and the costs of the initial decision on future maintenance and rehabilitation. And all of those get rolled up back into something called a net present value. And that's what we compare, is the net present value over a life cycle of the decision today and what the repercussions will be for maintenance and rehabilitation in the future.
John Harvey is a professor of civil and environmental engineering at UC Davis and director of the UC Pavement Research Center. The closure caused problems for a lot of travelers between Phoenix and LA, including truckers. Tony Bradley is president and CEO of the Arizona Trucking Association.
There are literally thousands of trucks going to and from California that use this route every day. So first and foremost, it was figuring out where to reroute those trucks, finding out where the trucks were on the route, if drivers were out of hours to drive. Obviously, if you're stuck in traffic, you have 11 hours you can drive during a day. You can get stuck and not have, literally have the ability to drive anymore without breaking regulations. From there, it was notifying customers that freight was going to be delayed and then telling them about the additional costs that, might be incurred because of the detour and because of the delay.
Are there enough detours? I mean, I-10's a pretty major freeway. Are there good alternative routes for, trucks to be driving on?
You know, this is in the middle of the desert. And the reality is that, no, there's not a good detour. I mean, these roads aren't made for that kind of capacity, passenger vehicles or truck traffic. I mean, we're talking between 20 and 30,000 vehicles a day now being put onto two-lane roads.
On the list of things that your members think about and are concerned about, where is infrastructure?
It's at the top of our, list. I mean, we advocate for infrastructure or, more funding for infrastructure almost on a daily basis. I mean, the roads are our office. And every day, the first thing that every driver thinks about is returning home safely. And if we have unsafe infrastructure, it makes it more challenging to do that. So infrastructure, funding, having good infrastructure is, critically important to us in our industry.
Overall, how is Arizona's infrastructure as far as your members are concerned?
You know, there was a recent report that showed Arizona's roads were given a D plus. We're in a unique situation because we are a young state, and Maricopa County has had a sales tax, Prop 300 and Prop 400, that funded Maricopa County's growth over the last 20, 30 years. So here in the county, we don't see the challenges you see once you get to the out counties. When we think about infrastructure, we have to think 20, 30 years out. And Arizona hasn't increased its formula or changed its formula on how it funds roads since 1992. 45 other states since 1992 have done something, have increased their funding mechanisms. We have not. And if you look at it now, we need to act now in order to be prepared for 5-10 years out.
In your perfect world, where does the money come from to do all these projects?
Right now, the way that our, infrastructure is funded is through essentially use fees. We've got the Highway User Revenue Fund here in Arizona, which comprises of the registration fee, some motor carrier fees, but a lot of it comes from the gas tax. And unfortunately, we called it the gas tax years ago. And people don't really understand that, you know, every gallon of gas you purchase or diesel, 18 cents of that in, the situation of gas goes into this Highway User Revenue Fund, and that goes to fund our highways. Now, back in 1992, when gas was 99 cents, you know, that was a pretty significant portion of that gas tax. However, it's flat. It's never, it hasn't increased since 92. And we look at a lot of different things. People want to talk about vehicle miles traveled as an option because they say it's a user fee. But there's challenges with that. Toll roads, there's people want to think it's a solution. But there's high cost of administration in that. And what's beautiful about the gas tax is it's a low cost of administration. It's hard to avoid, almost impossible to avoid paying it. So we look at that and we find that to be the best way to fund roads. You know, just raising it, you know, 10 cents would bring in significant money into the system. You know, and, what I often say about the gas tax is, kind of, I paraphrase what Winston Churchill said about democracy. Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government out there except for every other form of government. And the gas tax may be the worst form of way to collect revenue for roads, but it's better than every other form out there. It's the one we know. It's the one we trust. A modest increase would go a long way in making sure our roads are safe and we've got the, right infrastructure we need.
Tony Bradley is president and CEO of the Arizona Trucking Association. Tony, thanks.
Thank you very much.
It's the show. I'm Steve Goldstein, along with Mark Brody, and the takeaway is John Hockenberry. Here's a politically unlikely group of pals: California Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer, Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and Republican Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma. They've been working on a bipartisan long-term bill that would replenish the Highway Trust Fund, which runs out of money in just 10 days. Here's Senator McConnell on the issue.
My good friend, the Democratic leader, was saying as recently as a couple of weeks ago, we need to do a long-term highway bill. Well, Senator Boxer and I took him seriously, and we worked hard here to come up with a bipartisan, multi-year, paid-for highway bill.
The House of Representatives passed only a five-month extension bill last week, but the Senate hopes their long-term solution will end the latest uncertainty over highway funding. It's one of the issues on Capitol Hill. We're going to talk with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick now. Todd, welcome to the Takeaway.
Hi, John.
So everyone's happy about highway spending?
A lot of people in the Senate are happy because there weren't a lot of predictions that they would be able to do a deal like this. The deal isn't done, but cast your mind back to the annals of congressional dysfunction. John, since 2007, do you know how many times Congress has done a temporary little pothole fill, a little patch, a little temporary fix of the Highway Trust Fund? Just the Highway Trust Fund, 33 times, 33 times around the block, and they haven't managed to come up with a cohesive deal on the Highway Trust Fund. And it's a big deal. These are highway projects in all 50 states, every territory across the country, funded by the gas tax, the excise tax that you pay 18.4 cents per gallon when you pump gas. That hasn't gone up since 1993, and Congress isn't going to raise it. So they need to find another deal, and that's what Mitch McConnell is talking about. 3 years this would fund the Highway Trust Fund, $45 billion. But Congress can't raise taxes, can they? Not in this environment. They can raise fees, though. So TSA fees when you fly, those aren't going up. But instead of putting them into the general treasury, the Highway Trust Fund will take that. They're allowing some mortgage lenders to increase reporting requirements. They think they might get more enforcement money out of that. How about selling 101 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve? They're going to raise some money that way, too. There's a long list of ways to pay for this. Don't call any of them a tax increase. And McConnell and Boxer might have themselves a deal here.
Will they go along in the House?
Well, that's a big question. The House passed a five-month patch because they want to try to do something completely different after the August recess and after the new year. But here's part of the complication. It has to do with a lot of other issues. Senators want to bring back the Export-Import Bank. It went away because conservatives killed it on July 1st. Mitch McConnell wants to have a vote to attach it to this Highway Trust Fund. A lot of Republicans, many of them conservatives in the House, don't want that. They're going to have a fight over this, but Republicans in the Senate are going around saying privately, a lot of Republicans in the House, including John Boehner, like this deal. And if we send this $45 billion fix to the Highway Trust Fund over there, they're probably going to take it. We'll have to see.
We're a week into the 60-day countdown on the Iran deal. What's the tone of folks there up on the Senate floor?
Well, from Republicans in the House and the Senate, John, complete opposition. You've heard it. You've heard their opposition to the deal, to the president, and to John Kerry on this. Democrats divided, most of them keeping their powder dry, except for Nancy Pelosi, who came out strongly for this deal, and that was a boom for President Obama on selling this deal. Hillary Clinton, the Democratic frontrunner, also said she was for it. So that clock is ticking. Ernest Moniz, who's a physicist and the Secretary of Energy, on the Hill today and tomorrow, along with John Kerry, in classified briefings in the House and the Senate to try to sell this deal, which is probably going to be rejected by Congress. The question is, do they uphold a veto coming up after Labor Day?
The veto-proof question, and we will examine it after Labor Day. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it.
That's the Takeaways, John Hockenberry. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Hi, I'm Catherine Messenger, and I'm here at the Desert Botanical Garden for a flashlight tour on Thursday night. I'm a volunteer here, and tonight I am head of the agave station. The garden at night slowly becomes a very magical place. You can see the sky turning different colors.
And they call that nocturnal when they come out at night like that.
I thought it was nocturnal.
No, nocturnal.
And there are animals, especially at dusk, that are active at night. You might not see them, but you can hear them rustling around. I have a love of the Sonoran Desert. It's a place that I like representing to other people, both people that live here and people from other areas of the country that come through.
That was Catherine Messenger giving a flashlight tour at the Desert Botanical Gardens. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to tell us to stay in the dark, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic, 101 westbound, an accident at 7th Avenue. Also I-10 westbound, an accident in the median at 67th Avenue. Sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 105. Very, very slight chance of rain tonight. Overnight lows in the mid-80s. Right now, sunny skies, 100 degrees at KJZZ at 238.
KJZZ is supported by Smart Document Solutions. For 27 years, acting as a Xerox authorized sales agent, providing the entire portfolio of Xerox document solutions, including equipment, service, and fleet management. azsmartoffice.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nancy Lyons. The top Republican on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee says he thinks the U.S. was fleeced by Iran in recent nuclear negotiations. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Obama administration officials were on the Hill today defending the agreement.
Secretary of State John Kerry pushed back against the criticism of the deal, which he says will close off all pathways to a nuclear-armed Iran, and he called it fantasy, plain and simple, to suggest that the U.S. could have negotiated a better deal.
I know there are senators here who are uncomfortable with the idea that they may have an industrial enrichment program. So what's your plan? Knock out their entire capacity? Erase their memory of how to do a fuel cycle? Totally go to war?
Chairman Bob Corker accused Kerry of hyperbole for saying this is a choice between war and peace. Another Republican said Kerry was bamboozled. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
NASA is confirming the discovery of a planet that's the closest match yet to Earth. The Kepler telescope spotted it in a solar system about 1,400 light years away. John Grunsfeld, the Associate Administrator of NASA's Science Mission Directorate, says this discovery brings us closer to finding Earth 2.0.
Where did the universe come from? What's the fate of the universe? Where are we going? Not only from an intellectual point of view of, you know, what's the future of our solar system, of the universe, but where are we going as human beings? And of course, what I think is really the grand question, are we alone in the universe?
The research will be published in an upcoming issue of the Astronomical Journal. Jurors are unanimously in agreement that the Colorado theater attack that killed 12 was cruel enough to justify the death penalty for James Holmes. They are in the sentencing phase and say he murdered so many victims they should consider execution. On Wall Street today, losses across the board with the Dow dipping 119 points. This is NPR News.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. The Arizona Coyotes are staying in Glendale for the next season. The hockey team and city agreed to new terms today on an arena management deal. As KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan reports, the agreement only guarantees the team will stay until June of 2016.
The biggest change in the settlement is how the money changes hands. In the old contract, the city paid the Coyotes $15 million a year to manage the arena. The team ended up paying about half of that back to the city in revenue generated from parking and other fees. Now the city will pay the team a flat rate of $6.5 million a year to manage the arena, and the team will keep cash from parking and other services. Adam Caratogolo owns Opa Life Greek Cafe, a restaurant right next to Gila River Arena.
For us, and all the other restaurants that are here and retailers that are here, there's a lot of comfort there now, and that they can start doing improvements to their businesses. We can start hiring more people, which I'm prepared to start doing right away.
The team will also drop the lawsuit against the city as part of the settlement agreement. The Glendale City Council will vote tomorrow morning to finalize the contract. Alexandra Olgan, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
So as the Coyotes' off-ice drama has seemingly, emphasis on seemingly, calm down, the team is making significant changes on the ice to get younger. Is that the direction the organization needed to go in? With us to talk about the Coyotes' possibilities for success is Brendan Porter, managing editor of the Five for Howling site for SB Nation. Coyotes picked third in the NHL draft, and there were two can't-miss prospects.
Yes.
And so knowing basic math, that means they did not get one of those can't-miss prospects. But who did they get?
The Coyotes ended up selecting center Dylan Strom from the Erie Otters up in Canada with the third overall selection. After those first two players were Connor McDavid and Jack Eichel, the crop was still a very talented group of players, but it wasn't quite as clear-cut who would be that number three guy.
How long does it take even the best prospects to make it to the NHL, to where Coyotes fans will see an impact?
For guys like McDavid and Eichel, who are on a different kind of playing field relative to some of the other players. They're probably going to start next season in the NHL. They're pretty much ready to go.
Wow.
For somebody like Dylan Strom, some of the other picks that are kind of down that trajectory, third, fourth, fifth or so, it's not uncommon to see them wait a year or two, primarily because a lot of these guys are very young. Strom just turned 18 in March. So for a game like hockey, which is particularly known for its physicality, having an 18-year-old playing up against 25, 30-year-old players who know their stuff and have been in the league for a long time is not always the greatest idea.
So what's his skill level? What's he going to bring to the ice once he gets here?
Strom addresses, hopefully, one of the biggest glaring weaknesses the Coyotes have had ever since their attempt to develop Kyle Turris went south, is that Strom is a number one center in the making. He has a lot of height, he has a lot of speed, he has a lot of weight, he has playmaking ability, so he's kind of the complete package. And the Coyotes have had a number of stopgaps in that position for the past few years in players like Antoine Vermette and Martin Hanzel. But they've never had anybody that can really stack up against some of the best centers in the league like Anze Kopitar in Los Angeles or Ryan Getzlaf in Anaheim. So they figure that Strom is going to be that kind of guy who can anchor their top line going forward.
When you talk about young players, sometimes fans just need this idea of saying, yeah, we want to make the playoffs, we want to compete for a Stanley Cup, but in lieu of that, let's get some exciting new guys we can get behind. Do you see this as a possibility?
I think you have young forwards like Max Domi and Anthony Duclair who have a lot of creativity in their games. So, you know, you just have to go Google, you know, Max Domi incredible goal and you'll see some really highlight reel plays. Is he going to be making a lot of those in the NHL? Probably not against some of the more experienced defensemen and goaltenders, but you will see a lot of that kind of creativity. And I think that's going to make those sort of highlight shows either in the Valley or even sometimes across the country, which gets people interested. And then you also have players like Steve Downey and John Scott, who are not necessarily known as offensive juggernauts, but are certainly known for being kind of rough and tumble guys. And, you know, that's something definitely this franchise's fan base seems to really identify with, this kind of us against the world mentality. There's a very pack mentality to, you know, no pun intended. And I think that having players like Scott and Downey and Shane Doan, who can rough and tumble, who can drop the gloves and things like that, I think fans are going to really identify with that kind of thing.
Brendan Porter, he's the managing editor of the Five for Howling site for SB Nation, and we've been talking about the Arizona Coyotes.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody, along with Steve Goldstein. The show is a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and around the country, keeping you up to date and entertained.
KJZZ is supported by Honor Health. Scottsdale Healthcare and John C. Lincoln are now united under a single name, Honor Health, and are making healthy personal. More information can be found at honorhealth.com.
The U.S. has 78 million baby boomers, and they're living longer. They also want more choices in retirement than previous generations. The stereotype of golfing, fishing, and long naps simply doesn't apply anymore. That's led to the creation of specialized retirement communities. One of those in southern Arizona is Academy Village, which was initially founded as a place for former academics to gather and serve as a community of lifelong learners. Academy Village is still going strong. Mike Meharry has lived there for nearly 8 years.
I was drawn here certainly by the prospects for lifelong learning. I think that was the main thing. The more I investigated the place, though, the more I found to my satisfaction that they were also interested in lifelong wellness, fitness activities, health.
People can put things in a pamphlet and say, well, this is what you're going to get. But clearly Academy Village, the Senior Academy, are really providing it. What are some of the strengths that you've seen that have kept you there, in addition to actually what you just said about drawing you there?
Most of us are retired professionals of one kind or another. We are used to taking pleasure in our work, satisfaction from contributing to the greater good. And the people who live here are like-minded individuals, and we enjoy each other's company, and we spur each other on to volunteer activities and to help other people. And we offer our lectures and concert series open to the public to help encourage people to take advantage of our our offerings. It's a great benefit to have to live in a community of like-minded individuals.
As people live longer, do you think something like this is more valued, more needed in our society?
Oh, absolutely. I remember when I was young, I thought people my age, I'm now 74, when I thought in my youth about people who were 74, I thought of people who were, you know, had one foot in the grave. Now we're active. My wife and I teach yoga classes here at the Village, and we go biking and hiking, and we're out and about all the time. So, and so are our neighbors. You know, this is a very active community, even though we have people ranging in age from their 50s to well into their 90s.
When people live longer, you want to make sure that those years, one would think, as long as you're physically and mentally healthy, you would like to make sure that those years are worth living, right? It's not just say, hey, I'm just sort of counting down the clock.
Exactly. We don't view this as the end of the road. You know, this is just a new phase in our lives, and it's an exciting place to be, and it challenges us to be better, to work hard and find ways to contribute for the better, you know, for the greater good.
Mike Meharry is a resident of Academy Village in southern Arizona. He's also executive vice president of the Arizona Senior Academy. Mr. Meharry, thank you.
You're welcome. Nice talking to you.
The expansion and variety of retirement communities is a national phenomenon and something that Andrew Carl focuses on. Carl is executive in residence for the program in senior housing administration at George Mason University. Andrew, what changes have you seen in the past decade or so as far as senior housing options?
There was a worldwide study done about a decade ago, and it showed that it was the United States that actually invented the whole concept of the golden years. The problem was it lasted exactly one generation.
Okay.
And then either our parents told us or we learned from watching them that, you know, sitting on a rocking chair and watching the sun go up and down wasn't all it's cracked up to be. So what we're seeing really in the last decade, the last 15 years, is that whole transition. People today don't want to sit in a rocking chair on a porch. They want three things. They want active, they want intellectually stimulating, and they really want intergenerational retirement communities. They don't want to be schlubbed off to some elderly island and left on the porch.
Has there been a good transition into these things, or are there still lessons that are being learned? As we, Sarah, we know what people want. How hard is it to get those offerings in line with what people want?
Well, what happens in senior housing, Steve, is it's evolutionary. So we've gone from essentially having as our only choice in retirement either a nursing home or moving in with our kids to having at least some more choices. Assisted living 25 or 30 years ago was a huge change in the way that we perceived retirement. The ability to move into something that was very home-like, had a lot of hospitality features, but where you could still receive some assistance with your healthcare needs if you needed them. So we're seeing this transition away from institutional nursing home models to more home-like models. The next phase then is to expand the choices, and that's what we're really seeing now. So we want to expand on those choices. We want different kinds of assisted living communities that focus on particular interests or hobbies.
How many places can we have that do appeal to people with specific interests or specific backgrounds?
Well, here's the great thing with the baby boomers, and I'm one of them. There are 78 million of us. So we've basically done a fantastic job of exploding the portfolio products of every industry within which we've come into contact in every decade of our lives. I mean, we're the reason that Madison Avenue created 35 different flavors of baby food. The bottom line is when it comes to our retirement, we're not going to suddenly settle for vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry. And basically, you know, if you look at a typical assisted living community, is maybe 75 to 100 residents. A typical continuing care retirement community might be 250 to 300 residents. Well, out of 80 million, I mean, you can almost pick any topic or niche or hobby or interest that you want and probably fill a community. I've said for years somebody needs to build a retirement community for Grateful Dead fans. I could fill it overnight.
Are there enough people out there to take care of them and to provide them what they're looking for?
Well, it's a huge problem in terms of, you know, the plus side is you've got 78 million people and you can build all the different retirement communities you want. The downside is once they retire, the Labor Bureau estimates there'll be 35 million more jobs of any kind than people to fill them. So, I mean, you're absolutely right. We have to be able to staff these communities. Really, we're going to need to do two things when we retire. We're going to need to congregate anyway, because it's very inefficient to try to send someone out spending half the day looking at their windshield, driving to maybe four or five homes in an eight-hour shift, a nurse or a nurse's aide to help four or five people. That same nurse or nurse's aide in an assisted living or retirement community could have assisted 15 or 20 people in the same shift. We're really looking at having to move our baby boomers as we retire into congregate settings anyway. The good news being that we're not used to being alone and all grew up in the dorms anyway. So we won't mind that as much. But we do have to think about then our ability to really, you know, have enough people even in those communities, make them productive, bring in new technologies that can make them productive, and frankly count on ourselves as boomers to be able to stay independent for as long as we can and active in those communities for as long as we can.
Andrew Carl is executive in residence for the program in Senior Housing Administration at George Mason University. Andy, thanks for the insights. Fun talking to you.
Yeah, same.
And now it's time for the quiz show. That's when we bring back Leszek Pawlowicz, our resident quiz master who's won a Jeopardy Tournament of Champions. Each time he's on, he'll play one of us in a game of trivia hosted by our producer, Sarah Ventry. This week, he's playing KJZZ science reporter Andrew Bernier.
Over the last couple of weeks, we gave you a puzzle to solve and randomly selected two correct entries. The puzzle was an ape is trying to climb on a pole that is 60 feet high. Due to the slippery surface, the ape climbs 3 feet in a minute, only to slip back 2 feet. How much time will it take the ape to reach the top? The answer is 58 minutes. Our randomly selected winners this week are Adrian Major and Jennifer Liebhaber. Leszek will play on behalf of Adrian, and Andrew will play on behalf of Jennifer. Whoever wins will get a special KJZZ item.
Andrew and Leszek, you are both people of science, and you are both outdoorsy types, and I think you have a lot in common, but I have to say, Leszek, Andrew was talking a lot of smack before we started.
Oh, yeah. Mountains of smack.
He's ready to destroy you. So, Leszek, we'll let you go first since you're the reigning champ.
Okay.
All right, Leszek, what actor has reached a tentative settlement with the Water District in Ventura, California, after being accused of stealing water and bringing it across district boundaries during the California drought? Is it Tom Selleck, Andre Brower, or Jack Lord?
I'm so disappointed in Magnum PI. It's Tom Selleck.
It is Tom Selleck.
Oh, well, I mean, he hasn't really been doing a whole lot lately. So, I mean, if the one way to get on TV. So, there you go.
Andrew, last week, South Carolina State Representative Jenny Horn made a passionate, tearful speech to South Carolina's House of Representatives about why the state should remove the Confederate battle flag from the state house grounds. Jenny Horn is a descendant of which famous Confederate? Robert E. Lee, Jefferson Davis, or Stonewall Jackson?
That would be Jefferson Davis.
It is Jefferson Davis.
All right.
So we're at 1-1. Leszek, New York Giants defensive end Jason Pierre-Paul became a statistic this year when he was injured on the 4th of July as a result of mishandled fireworks. What happened to him as a result of the accident? Was it that one of his fingers was amputated? He had second-degree burns on his hands, arms, and chest? Or he fell over and twisted his ankle?
One of his fingers got amputated.
That is correct. And we only know that because of a fantastic HIPAA violation. All right, Andrew, you know I love celebrity gossip.
Oh, yes, you do.
Which celebrity couple did not break up recently? Is it Jennifer Garner and Ben Affleck, Ryan Gosling and Ava Mendez, or Kourtney Kardashian and Scott Disick?
Gosling and Mendez.
You are right. Love will never die. They will always be together.
I can only hope.
Okay, Leszek, nothing says summer quite like a big scoop of ice cream. What ice cream company is gearing up to start test production on new batches after it was forced to halt production for some time due to a listeria outbreak? Is it Breyers, Häagen-Dazs, or Bluebell?
It was Bluebell.
It is Bluebell. All right, Andrew, that means this last question you have to get right in order to force a tiebreaker. Otherwise,
right.
Leszek takes home the prize again. All right. And all your smack talk is for naught.
Oh, no.
Andrew, one soda company has announced that beginning in August, it will start selling aspartame-free diet soda. Which brand is it? Is it Diet Coke, Diet Sprite, or Diet Pepsi?
Oh, man, this one will be a shot in the dark. I'm going to go with Pepsi, Diet Pepsi.
You are correct.
Excellent.
It's Diet Pepsi.
Nice shot in the dark.
Thank you.
All right. The two of you have forced me to give you a tiebreaker question. So just a reminder, the answer is a numeric answer. You will both have an opportunity to answer, and whoever is closer to the right answer will win. According to 2010 data from Ad Age, how much soda does an American drink each year? Leszek, what's your answer?
Ooh, this is going to be a shot in the dark as well, too. I'm going to say, do you have a specific unit you want it in? Quarts, gallons?
I guess it depends on how much soda you think an average American drinks.
I will say 70 gallons.
All right, Andrew?
Well, actually, the number that I had entered my head was 60 gallons, so I think I'll stick with that one.
It's 44.7 gallons, which means, Andrew, you have defeated Leszek.
Congratulations.
I've been working on this mountain of smack for so long, and I have now reached the summit. So, Leszek, thank you.
Nice job.
Appreciate it.
And we'll keep bringing Leszek back, so stay tuned for the next listener puzzle and your chance to be one of our at-home players.
Make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 for the show, why in-person storytelling is gaining popularity, and the economics of rural air service. Those stories and plus much more tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock right here on the show.
The show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer, Sky Shab, Maria Springs of the digital team, our news director, Al Macias. Our executive producer is John, the ubiquitous one, Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know some good story ideas. We're at the show at kjzz.org. And if you'd like to podcast the show, you can do it totally free. Just download the KJZZ mobile app at the App Store or Google Play. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. For Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Thanks so much for listening. All Things Considered is next. It's 3 o'clock.
KJZZ is supported by Valley Metro, working to benefit the community, including those who rarely use public transit, by creating sustainable jobs through further development of the transportation system. ValleyMetro.org/connected.